Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, July 17th, 2011, and this is show number 321. Well, this week was the deadline for submissions for Blog World Expo presentations, so Katie Floyd and I were hard at work getting our papers in. We submitted two panel ideas where it's the two of us, and one of them would be an in-depth tutorial on how to make a good audio podcast, you know, how to make sure that you don't get peaking in your audio and all that kind of stuff. And the other one is more of a beyond the technical talk, how to figure out what needs you can actually fill with the podcast, how to grow your audience, all that kind of thing. I think both talks would be really compelling. Maybe they'll pick us both of them for both of us, I should say. I also submitted one for how to make a live video podcast, because I'm getting pretty good at this, except for when I forget to do stuff. And anyway, I think I've learned a lot in the last year, and I think I have a lot to add to the show, so I hope at least one of those three papers gets picked. Blog World Expo, by the way, is November 3rd to 5th, 2011 in Los Angeles this year, and early bird pricing ends on July 21st. Now, you really want to check that out, because if you're going to go for a full access pass, it's actually 30% off the price to get it by July 21st. And they've got a lot of different variations on which sessions you can go to in the show. Anyway, check it all out at blogworldexpo.com. Last week, I reviewed the Samsung 4G hotspot, and I wasn't very kind to it. Now, while it achieved amazing bandwidth speeds, two separate devices were not able to keep a Wi-Fi connection. The woman who supplies me with these devices started accusing me of somehow sabotaging them. I was vindicated this week, though, when I received not one, but two letters about the Samsung 4G hotspot. The first is from David Roth. He wrote, "Same experience with two different Samsung 4G hotspots. No such problems with the 4G Novatel MiFi." And then a little later from Joseph Coletti, he said, "Your review of the Samsung 4G LTE device was right on the money. I bought this when it first came out and it was not good. About 1 week after I bought it, the Novatel 4G MiFi came out. I brought the Samsung back and exchanged it for the Novatel MiFi. I've been very happy with my old 3G MiFi and the 4G MiFi now works flawlessly." So what am I going to do? Stick with the old cruddy one? Nope, ditched it. Got rid of the Samsung device, the second one, and I got the Novatel device, affectionately known as the Verizon Wireless 4G LTE Mobile Hotspot MiFi Registered Trademark 4510L. Tell you what, we'll call it the Novatel 4G Hotspot, shall we? All right, the most important thing to tell you about this device is that, unlike the Samsung, it actually works. I haven't lost my Wi-Fi connection once in the past week, so right there I'm pretty much willing to forgive it some of its other smaller shortcomings. But let's talk about the good stuff first. The Novatel 4G hotspot is about 2.5 times as thick as the old 3G MiFi from Verizon, making it, I don't know, 3/8, almost a half an inch thick. A lot bulkier, but it's still a pretty light device. I can throw it in my purse and I don't even notice it's there. This one has a lovely LCD display on the top. It's a grayscale LCD, but nonetheless, it shows me my signal strength, my battery life, and how many computers are connected to it. That battery life indicator is the most beautiful thing. Knowing how much time you have left is essential on a little device like this. Now, I haven't completed my battery test yet, but since the Samsung device went a grand total of 40 minutes, it's not going to be too hard to step over that bar for the Novatel. I'm definitely getting more than 2 hours out of it. I suspect it's more in the 3 to 4 hour time frame. Just like your gas gauge, though, I have noticed that the last couple of bars of battery life slip away much faster than the first two. So do keep that in mind when you're looking at it. On Verizon's 4G LTE network, you get some amazing speeds. I took a couple of snapshots. The first one was 18 megabits per second down and 7 up. The second time I did it, I got 17 megabits down, 20 megabits per second up. Steve and I remain baffled at how we can be getting over-the-air speeds that trounce the speed we get from our physical cable connection. I suppose it's because they're probably metering it on us to get us to pay more. Anyway, the Novatel 4G hotspot also has a light indicator on the side that tells you the status of your connection to the internet. Now, I know they're trying to be helpful with all the little different colors it displays, but there's so many options that it's pretty confusing. I've actually been carrying around the 73-page PDF manual. I printed it double-sided in 2 pages per page until I can memorize exactly how this thing works. So here's the way the lights break down. A solid green light means it's got a 4G signal, but nothing's connected to it. Blinking green means it's got the 4G signal, but it's also transmitting data. A solid violet light means it's on 3G, but nothing connected. Blinking violet means it's got 3G and is transmitting. Solid amber means the device is in power down mode, but not yet off. Blinking amber means the device is powered off, but charging. Okay, now those are only the colors I actually care about. There's red and white too, but I don't want to bore you too much. Just bore you enough to realize why I'm carrying the darn 73-page manual around. The one big disappointment is that the NovaTel 4G hotspot will not provide a Wi-Fi signal while you're charging it via USB, and it doesn't even appear to allow you to even run the stupid VZ Access software to use it as a USB modem. That's what I used to do as a workaround on the old Verizon MiFi until I found the hack for it. I got to tell you, at least in my perusing of the 73-page manual, I could not find it, and I did some searching online that most people were saying that they couldn't find it either. Now, there was some talk about opening a .pkg file on the Mac or running a .exe file on Windows. That was all in the manual, but they didn't really say where to get those files, and it wasn't clear whether that would actually give me VZ access. It might. Now that I think about it, I might be able to just go find the software online and download it. On the older devices, though, when you plug them in via USB, they mounted a CD image, and then you could install the software if you wanted to. I'll keep hunting around, but they sure could have made that easier. At least you can charge it via the included wall charger, but you know how often that when you're mobile do you have easy access to a power port? The NovaTel 4G hotspot has a full router interface via the familiar 192.168.1.1 you type into your browser. One feature I did find by reading the 73-page manual was that it supports a temporary network, so you can let people borrow a cup of internet without having to change your own security settings. That was pretty cool. The other one didn't do that. I should say, though, that the very first thing you should do when you get the device is to change the admin password, because it's simply admin. Yeah, that's great. Anyway, you can set up high-level security, WPA2 with TKIP encryption, with a strong password both to administer the device and actually access the Wi-Fi network. They really should have had that near the beginning of the 73-page manual, don't you think? The NovaTel 4G hotspot allows you to change the settings on how soon it shuts down when it's idle. You can set it from anywhere from 2 to 60 minutes or even set it to never. I thought that was pretty cool. I think the one on the Samsung was set to 30 seconds and you couldn't change it. Or maybe that was their excuse. Anyway, there's one unexplained port on the NovaTel 4G hotspot. It's a wee tiny little circular port covered with a wee tiny little rubber cover. I asked Steve what he thought it might be, and he suggested it might be to attach an external antenna. That's kind of an interesting option. Now, I didn't quickly find a list of accessories for the NovaTel 4G hotspot, but maybe the idea of adding that little antenna attachment might be coming later. And by the way, in the 73-page manual, they did not mention that little tiny port. The only other thing I wanted to comment about this device is that I often found I had to re-enter my password to connect to the NovaTel 4G hotspot, even though I had set it to remember the password in my keychain. Now, that's, you know, in entirely new sessions, but I'm not quite sure why it did that. It wasn't a huge hassle, but kind of dumb. All right, bottom line time. The NovaTel 4G hotspot beats the pants off the Samsung 4G LTE mobile hotspot, not only because it actually works, but because of the display showing battery life and signal strength and the good web interface to change options on the device. I even found that by downloading the configuration file, I could actually change the number of connected devices it would allow. I'm going to try to set it to 6 and see if it actually works, because they always say it's only up to 5. Full retail price on the NovaTel 4G hotspot is $270. With a 2-year contract, though, it comes down to $100, but they have an online discount that brings it down to $50. That 2-year contract is going to run you $50 a month for 5 gigabytes per month, or $80 for 10 gigabytes per month. And of course, there's an early termination fee of $175 from Verizon. So now, think about those fees. At $600 per year for this device, it's definitely not cheap, but we saw speeds, especially upstream, that were way better than our cable modem. If I lived by myself, I think I'd buy one of these in a heartbeat and cut that cable internet service. This week, I was messing around in Google Plus, rearranging my circles. As you get into it, you might find out, like I did, that some early assumptions about what's right for you turn out not to be quite the way you want it later. I had a giant pile of people in one circle, But then there was a subset of those people that I also wanted in a smaller circle. Let's, for example, call the big circle friends, but the subset is close friends. I wanted to figure out how to copy people from friends to close friends without removing them from the friends circle. I was working away at it by hand, very inefficiently, when Connor P. jumped on to chat with me. I told him what I was trying to do, and he stopped talking for about 5 minutes. I figured, you know, a squirrel must have walked by outside, and he'd forgotten that we were even talking. But then suddenly he popped back in with, "Check Dropbox." To my delight, Connor had created a very short little screen steps lesson showing me exactly how to reorganize my circles in Google+. What's interesting about this is that in less time than I could execute the maneuver the hard way, Connor had created simple instructions with beautiful screenshots and annotations to show me how to do it the easy way. It took him less than 5 minutes, and it saved me about 10 minutes. I put a copy of a screen steps tutorial in the show notes, so if you ever need to do this, you're going to have it handy. Once I'd posted it, I thought, what the heck, I should post it on Google+, and a whole bunch of people plus one that little tutorial saying, oh man, I'm probably going to need this later, I want to keep an eye on that. So he helped a bunch of people, took him 5 minutes, he looks like a hero, it's all awesome. Think about how helpful you could be to your friends, families, colleagues, if you bought screen steps like Connor P. did. Check out their free 30-day trial over at screensteps.com and be sure to tell them that Allison sent you. You know what? The No Silla Castaways rock. On Friday morning, I realized that I kind of sort of forgot to actually start writing the podcast. So it wasn't my fault, really. Remember the part where Katie Floyd insisted that we actually get our Blog World Expo submissions in on time and not miss the deadlines? Well, I was working on that instead of the show. It's my excuse and I'm going with it. Well, not to worry. I sent out a call on Twitter asking for reviews, and the No Silla Castaways came through in spades. Good thing. Wouldn't have to want to do my own job here now, would we? Let's start off with Caleb's review of Think from freeverse.com/think.
Ahoy, Captain Allison and fellow No Silla Castaways. Caleb, a.k.a. Geeka Supremo on Twitter here. This time to talk about another simple and useful app. First, a problem to be solved. Focus. No, I'm not talking about photography. By focus, I mean channeling attention. In this case, on one app. A lot has been made about full-screen apps lately. And while that's all fine and good, it's not a perfect solution. Sometimes you don't need an app to fill the screen, you just need to turn down the noise of all your other apps and desktop. This is where Think from Freeverse comes in. It's a free and simple app that will gracefully turn down the visual background of a cluttered or normal desktop and leave you with a visually striking way to divert most of your focus to the one app you really want to use. When you launch the app, it will present you with a darkened screen and a strip of icons showing your active apps. They call this the Illumination Panel. It looks like what you get when you press Command Tab. Once you select the app you want from the panel, it will be brought to the front of the backdrop. The backdrop creates a visual separation from your other apps. You can change its color and transparency from the control panel. The control panel is a floating toolbar that will always allow you control over Think. There's a very good breakdown of the interface on the Think webpage at freeverse.com. I find this app especially useful when writing. It allows me to let text edit take front and center in my mind and on the screen while still letting me look at Firefox and iTunes in the background without having to give them my full attention. If I need to read the Freeverse page in Firefox more clearly, I can click its stock icon to bring it to the front. Once assuring myself that I have the details correct, I can click the backdrop to bring the text edit back to focus again. So to conclude, Think from Freeverse will help you focus on one app at a time. It's free, universal, and compatible up to Snow Leopard. I find it to be useful since it allows me to raise and lower apps as needed, unlike a full-screen app. And did I mention it's free and universal? Because that's really great for all of us who are still using PPC-based Macs. Hope this helps you all with your workflow. Till next time, ciao.
That sounds perfect for most of us, Caleb. And it seems like everyone has ADD these days. I think I'm going to give Think a try. I need all the help I can get. Well, this weekend, I finally took Bart's advice and finally cleaned up my operating systems. The operative word there is the S on the end of the word system, my operating systems. When I very cleverly put an SSD in place of my optical drive, I left the operating system and applications that were living on my hard drive. I just left them in place. I thought that was very clever of me, because now if my solid-state drive failed me, I could always boot to my hard drive. The problem is that the applications kind of get confused when there's two operating systems running around because there's two sets of library slash application support folders and all that kind of stuff. Plus, whenever I did a right-click open with, I'd get two of every application, one on each drive, and of course the ones on the hard drive were getting sorely out of date. Now that I think about it, the operating system over there was getting kind of old and stale too. So after some strategic brainstorming with Bart, I did a final backup of the hard drive, held my breath, and I erased the drive. Okay, that didn't actually work. I couldn't unmount the hard drive. Bart said that was because of the crosstalk that was going on between these two drives, these applications writing things back and forth. He said, just boot from your Snow Leopard CD. All right, no problem. I did that, and I got a kernel panic. Twice. All right, he then suggested I make sure that I'm using the right Snow Leopard DVD CD. Well, sure enough, I was using the one from my Family Pack license, not the new one that came with the new MacBook Pro. Bart, ever patient Bart, explained that the older Snow Leopard DVD didn't know about the newer model, so it wouldn't have the right drivers on it to do the job. You know, it's really sad. For someone who's supposed to be really good at this stuff, I sure always have a lot to learn. Like I always tell people, no matter how much you know about this stuff, there's always somebody who knows more, and no matter how little, there's always somebody who knows less. Anyway, I finally dug out the right Snow Leopard DVD, I erased the hard drive, and then I simply dragged my home folder back to the clean disk. Bart did suggest I not name it Macintosh Hard Drive because so many applications look there for stuff, and we don't want the applications ever looking at it. After booting into the solid state drive in the admin account, I then had to run a command line change ownership command to make the ownerships between the Allison account on the solid state drive and the hard drive identical. That command, if you really care, and it's written down in the show notes, is sudo space chown space dash capital R space Allison space volume slash the hard drive name slash Allison. Okay, that's really boring to say it out loud. You can go look in the show notes if you need it. Now I was able to repeat the trickiest bit I had done of the whole running off of two separate disks thing. The trick here is you select the Allison account. Well, yours might not be called Allison, but mine is. You select the Allison account on the hard drive in the account's preference pane. But if you right-click on it, you get to the advanced menu, and in there, you can say, make this my home folder. It's kind of complicated how to do it, so if you ever do need how to know how to do it, I put a link in the show notes to a very tongue-in-cheek description of the path, complete with screenshots over at ransom-note-typography.com. I think you'd enjoy reading it in any case. Anyway, after all these shenanigans were over, I assumed I'd carry on about my business. But it turns out that's when I started to figure out exactly how wonky things really were with apps crossing lines between the solid state and spinning hard drives. The most sad part of this whole thing was that all of my snippets from Text Expander had disappeared. And Bart was offline. He was trying to have his own life because I'd been pestering him for like 3 hours by this time. So I decided to write him an email about it. And that is the actual point of this long diatribe. It was impossible to type that email without Text Expander. I could not believe how many things I went to type and realized I had to type out the whole entire words. It was barbaric, I tell you. Just Text Expander alone is 12 characters. My snippet is only 3 for that. So that meant I had to type 9 extra characters every time I typed Text Expander. And the whole email was about Text Expander. So that was 9, 9, 9, 9. Oh, it was horrible. Snow Leopard came up a few times too, and that's another extra 9 characters. Heck, even my signature was gone. If you're not using Text Expander, you would never understand the pain I was suffering because you're doing all that extra typing every day, and you don't even realize how much time you could be saving. If you download the free trial of Text Expander, I guarantee you you'll be hooked. If you do go ahead and buy it, would you believe they have a 90-day money-back guarantee? That's faith in your product. I don't even give you a 90-day money-back guarantee on the podcast. Make haste. Go over to smilesoftware.com, check out Text Expander, and be sure to tell them that you heard about it on the NoSillaCast. And, in case you're still worried, Kyle Mag and Stu Helm helped me out on Twitter to get my precious Text Expander snippets back up and running, so I did survive the whole debacle. Next up, we've got a review from longtime NoSilla Castaway, one of the lead NoSilla Castaways, I think I'd have to say, Wade Gutman, a.k.a. Gutmach1960 on Twitter. He took a very different approach to solve the problem of a car without an iPod port to the stereo head unit. He bought an entirely new head unit for his car. And of course, he got it from Crutchfield. Let's have a listen to his review.
Hello, Allison and Anostella Castaway. This is Wade Gutman, better known by my handle, Gutmuch. A short time ago, there was a problem to be solved. How to play audio file from an iPhone or iPod Touch in a car audio system. Allison's solution was to go with a third-party add-on for a Honda OEM system. My solution was to replace the stock head unit in my Toyota Tacoma. The replacement unit is a Sony DSX S200X and an FM-AM digital media player. The Sony we purchased to Crushfield.com. It came with an installation kit for my 2007 Tacoma. It looked Toyota made. It even came with its own remote. The Sony digital media player is also available to Best Buy. The Sony did not play CDs, but had two USB connectors, one internal, the other one on the face of the unit. It would play MP3, WMA, and AAC file. No support for Ogborvis, though. The following are compatible with this head unit: iPod Nano, 3rd, 2nd, and 1st generation, iPod Classic, iPod Touch, iPhone 4, 3GS, 3G, and the iPhone. It's also played nice with the SanDisk Cruiser 4GB. Now I can listen to my iTunes library, LibriVox audiobooks, or Pandora while driving during the dry, hot month that is Arizona summer. Problem solved. There are photos of Sony DSX X200X in my Toyota with a different way of connecting the iPhone and a SanDisk for playback on the block.
Thanks, Wade. This is a great solution. I actually did that, or should I say I had Honda Bob do that, for both of my kids' cars, too. And of course, I use Crutchfield for the purchase. I love those guys. With my car, I had the nav system put in, though, when I bought it, so I'd have had to toss that whole thing out in order to just get the head unit replaced. You can't just replace the radio. So, they charge an arm and leg for the nav system in cars, so that wasn't going to be a good option for me. But thanks for letting everyone know about another great option for getting an iPod connection kit into your car. One more thing, the Sony DSX S200X that he got from Crutchfield will run you right around $200. So as I mentioned earlier, I put the call out to people on Twitter asking whether they could do some reviews for me, and someone volunteered to do a review for me but wanted it as a conversation. So today we're going to talk about ClamX AV. Why don't you start us off, a guest?
Guest? Have I been reduced to guest? No, okay.
Well, it's not a chit-chat across the pond. Don't get confused.
Okay, so I need to be shorter then, is it?
I think that's the only distinction, and I didn't start it out with the right music.
Ah, okay. I'm sure it was lovely music. So a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about AV on the Mac because of all the, viruses. Well, not viruses, but Trojans and stuff on the Mac. Mac Defender and its ilk.
Malware.
And I was disparaging of ClamX AV because I had tried the 1.x version of ClamX AV a few years ago, and it was awful, quite frankly. It was horrible. I hated it with a passion. It left such an impression on me that I didn't actually want to try it again. But after I was snarky about it on the NozillaCast, George from Tulsa got in touch and set me straight on some things and said, you really should try it again because they've gone to 2.0 and they've really changed everything up and it's actually really quite good now.
Yeah, he runs a network of Macs too, so he's got some challenges with it.
Exactly. So I figured, okay, if it works in the real world for George, I'll give it a go. What's the worst that can happen? So I did.
That's a scary sentence, but go ahead.
Yeah, it's pretty bad, yeah. But I was on the lookout anyway, because this antivirus thing is becoming important. I have family members who are starting to ask questions, and I figured I needed to get to the bottom of this. I suggested the free one from the App Store, but it's only a scanner on demand, so it doesn't really help you out in sort of the way you expect an antivirus to do.
So it's not keeping out for you. It's a fence you put up from time to time manually?
It's a little verification that everything's still okay that you have to remember to run from time to time, but it's not any sort of defense against getting them.
So okay.
I figured it was time to experiment with some real antivirus on the Mac, and I didn't really feel like spending $60 on one of the commercial products.
And the bloatware.
So so a free Clamex AV sounded like it was worth a try again, especially with George's recommendation. So I did. And so I've been running it for 3 weeks now. And it's working. So
really?
I figured we should talk about it.
It's not nasty?
Doesn't seem to be. I haven't noticed any difference in performance. I haven't noticed it cause any trouble. It's just sort of there and does its thing.
Wow.
So anyway, it's Clamex AV, and it's an OS X version of the free and open source Clam AV antivirus package that started off in Linux and is now on Windows as well as Clam Win. And this is the Mac version, Clamex AV.
Okay.
So under the hood, it's a Linux tool. So if you're nerdy in command line, you can dive in there and you'll find all of your favorite Linux command line stuff in there. But it does have a very nice native OS X GUI wrapped around it. So what it provides you, I guess, is five things. So you have a GUI to initialize an on-demand scan of folders on your computer. So a little GUI, it has a couple of pre-populated things you might want to scan down the side, and you just click a folder and hit scan, and it scans and it tells you what it finds. So very much like if you launch Norton or something, you ask it to do a scan.
And that's the kind of capability that would be available if you just did the version from the App Store.
Exactly. That is exactly the functionality you get from the App Store, and that's all you get from the App Store.
All right.
The other thing you have then is it puts a little service into your Finder, so you can right-click on any file or folder in the Finder and say scan with Clamex AV,
right?
Which is also handy. It also has a little scheduler built in, which allows you to auto-update your virus definitions at a given interval, and even to automatically scan some or all of your computer at a given interval as well. So you basically drag and drop in the folders you want and tell it how often and when.
Hmm. Okay.
So you have a scheduling process. What you also have then in the background is a background sort of process, very much like you've come to expect from Windows AV, that's sitting in the background watching stuff going on, which is called Clamex AV Sentry. And so that can run in the background. And then if you have that background process running, you have a nice little menu bar app that lets you interact with Clam. And it's actually quite a good little menu bar app that gives you all the important functions you'd want and sits out of your way nicely. So I'm actually really happy with that.
What's the difference between having it watching a set of specific folders and having a schedule that has it watch a set of folders?
Well, if you have a schedule, it would scan your folder, say, once a day or whatever. Whereas if you have the Sentry running, it will scan, it will look for changes.
Oh, okay. Okay, so like right after you download something, it would notice that and go in and,
exactly.
and check it out?
So,
okay.
Exactly. It's actively watching the folder for a file changing or a file appearing. And
okay.
it will say,
oh, cool.
Must check that one. Oh, must check that one.
So it's not actually scanning it as it comes in. It's scanning it after it came in.
Well, as soon as the file system changes, it will notice a change and go check it.
Okay.
So that's pretty good. So that's what you want. So there's sort of the chunks. That's what you get for your non-money.
So there's the free version on the App Store, and then there's the free version at clamxav.com?
Well, the App Store is a completely different product, so that's not confusing. That was just something I recommended a few weeks ago, so ignore that. So clamxav.com is this product we're talking about.
Okay, I got you.
So I broke it down, as I always do, into the good and the bad, and then I have some recommendations afterwards. So the first thing to say is the GUI is clear and simple, and it's pretty Mac-like. Could do with a little bit of polish here and there, but it's a Mac GUI. It's not a fake Cocoa GUI or anything. It's a proper Mac GUI.
Okay.
Definitely a massive improvement over the version 1 I tried a few years ago.
Yeah, you said it was real janky looking.
Oh, it was awful. It was by nerds for nerds software.
All the best that Linux brings you, right? Oh, yeah. not to disparage Linux.
Well, no, but it's not... It's for a different class of user who doesn't care about UI. the menu bar, so if you're running Sentry, is actually really nice. I'm very happy with it. It changes, so if you turn off the on-demand scanner, it grays itself out. If it's doing something, it sort of animates itself. And you can use it to see at a glance what folders you're watching. You can use it to add more folders without even having to open, you know, just straight from the menu bar up, say add, remove folders. You can launch the full GUI, you can update your virus definitions, and you can start, stop, and restart the little background process. And you can access the scan log and the update log to see what it's been up to.
Hmm.
And you can quit it if you decide again you don't want it running after all. So
what kind of intervals are you setting for stuff? Like, are you having it check daily for virus definitions, hourly, monthly?
In my home machine, I'm setting it daily. And I'm setting it in the evening time when I know the computer will be on. Whereas in my work machine, I'm setting it week daily because that's one of the options.
Oh, okay.
And I'm setting it for a time when I'll be at work so that the machine will definitely be on.
Okay. All right. And what about how often it's scanning and that sort of thing? Or is that not something, or I'm sorry, which folders you're having it scan? Are you just having it do downloads or everything?
I was going to say, I was going to get to that later when I get to my suggestions for how to set this up.
Okay, great.
Because it depends a little on your situation, what I'd recommend.
For once, I didn't read ahead in the show notes. I usually try to ask it to write when you're ready to say it. But
that's fine.
All right, and as you've mentioned, it's also free.
It's free, yes.
Okay.
So the next thing I have down on my list of good things is that the control over what that background agent does is nice and granular. So you can choose to have it just watch everything, or you can choose to have it only watch certain folders that you're interested in. So if you have an older machine and you're a bit more concerned about resources, have it watch less. Mm-hmm. Or if you have a really modern machine and all you do is check your email and read the web, yeah, okay, let it watch more. It won't do you any harm because you're not using your CPU anyway.
All right.
It also lets you control what you do when it finds something. So does it just tell you it's found something? Does it completely delete it? Or does it quarantine it?
Okay.
Which is very reasonable.
Right.
If it's a resource hog, it's been really quiet about it because I simply haven't noticed.
So have you been watching any of your processes or anything to see how much is being used or anything like that?
No, what I've been doing is seeing if I notice my machine as I do my daily work, seeing if I notice it sort of being slower than it used to be, and I simply don't.
I guess that's what's really important, right?
Exactly. I don't care. I mean, it's going to use some CPU. How else can it possibly do its work?
Right.
But I haven't seen that I'm suddenly out of memory, and I haven't seen lots of spinning beach balls, and I haven't felt my machine become sluggish and unresponsive. I just plain old haven't noticed.
Okay.
So that's probably as high a praise as you can get for Navy, that you just don't notice.
Sure, sure. That's not common.
Certainly not with the
Nortons of the world.
Nortons, McAfees, etc., etc., etc.
Right.
I also like that it has Growl integration. That may not be a big deal for some people, but it is for me. I just like that.
Now, did it obey and say, would you like to have Growl, or did it just install it without asking?
Well, I have Growl installed.
Okay.
So it just used the Growl I have.
That's right. That's right. Okay.
So if you say, check for or update your definitions now through the menu bar app, it's going to do its thing in the background. And when it's done, it'll just pop up a little Growl and say, yeah, I'm done. So I like that.
Okay.
If you're a terminal geek, it is the full Unix Clam AV under the hood. It's all in there. All of those config files to do all of the advanced stuff, it's all in there. The GUI doesn't present you all of the advanced features, but they're there. So if you're nerdy enough to care, play away.
The best of both worlds.
Exactly, and it's free, which is I have down on the good list.
Okay.
There is a bad list, though, because this is me.
I was going to say, this is a little weird.
I don't ever give complete praise to anything.
Sure.
So the first thing I ran into, and it made me very cranky for a day, is I need to be able to use proxy servers to access the internet. Mm-hmm. It's not uncommon in corporate environments.
Sure.
And it does not obey the OS X system-wide proxy settings. And the GUI does not allow you to specify the proxy in the app.
Why would it need to know your proxy settings?
How's it going to update virus definitions if we can't get access to net?
There you go. Okay.
Okay, so yes, it has to be able to get its virus definitions, and it has to have internet access for that, and it has to be able to use proxies if you have to use proxies.
Okay.
And there was simply no way to do it through the GUI, and I tried to trick it using apps that sort of Proxifier and all those kind of things, and it was a horrible mess, and I got very cranky, and I tweeted a lot, and it was not pleasant. And then I did a little bit of... That sort of had this brainwave. I was like, wait a second, this is a full Linux app. So just because the GUI doesn't have it doesn't mean the app can't do it. And I just did a little search for clam.conf. And I was like, oh, there it is, /user/local/clam.xav. Okay. So I found the config file, entered in the proxy settings, and hey presto, it works.
Excellent.
So if anyone else is running into that problem, I wrote a blog post, which is linked in the show notes, explaining exactly where the file is and exactly how you have to edit it, but it's exceptionally self-explanatory. You just have to uncomment the line that says proxy server and put in the right details.
Okay, cool.
Something that made me cranky, though, when I ran it, I found a few viruses, nothing spectacular, some Word macros and a dodgy PDF. But what did make me cranky was that you can't find out anything about the virus. It tells you you have this virus and there's no way to click on it. There's no way to know anything about that virus. I was not able to find anything about the PDF virus I was supposed to have. And maybe that's just the nerd in me that cares what it is, but I don't think it's unreasonable.
I'd want to know what it is. You know, which one did I get?
Exactly.
Okay.
So I thought that was a bit annoying. And in my case, I must have had something very obscure because even Googling the name gave me nothing. So that was annoying. The GUI lists the files it finds that are infected and tells you what virus they have, but there's no way to get it to show you where on your file system that is as part of the list. So it's a standard OS X list that you can resize the width of the columns and stuff, and you can reorder them by picking them and dragging them and dropping them. But in the Finder, if you have the list view and you right-click, you can add or remove fields. No such option here. And I really want to see where on my system those files are at a glance.
Sure.
So the only way to do that is to right-click on each file one by one and say show path. Don't like that.
Is that written in the show notes correctly, your opinion on that?
I haven't phrased it quite like that.
Okay.
The defaults... Now, this, I'm not sure. I have this down on the bad because I think it's not good for regular users, but power users may think this is actually a positive feature. The default settings are immensely unintrusive. Basically, okay. It does nothing.
Okay.
Which you could argue means it's not a resource hog, but it comes with basically everything turned off, and then you have to turn everything on. So you have to say, yes, I wanted the started login. Yes, I wanted to scan in the background. Here's what I wanted to scan. You have to do all of these things before it does anything useful.
So I would think the best way would be some sort of a little wizard to go through, you know, that tells you these are your options rather than having to go click through options and figure it out.
I think so. A little first run sort of wizard says, hi, this is the first time you're using ClamXFE. Do you want to configure it for or maybe give two or three broad options?
And maybe some advice, you know. Yeah, just a little bit of guidance.
For home uses, we recommend. For power users, we recommend. Right.
If you don't know what you're doing, click here.
Exactly. Just some sort of help.
I don't always want that, but there's days, you know?
Especially for something like an AV, you don't really want to get that wrong.
Right.
You don't want to be under any sort of confusion that, you know, I've installed this, therefore I'm protected. No. No, you're not.
Right.
So, you know, I think they could do better there. The other thing, they have a feature which is very powerful, so you can specify a pattern of files to exclude. So you tell it what folder to search for, but you may just say, look, I really don't want you sitting there scanning all of my .iso files. They're bloody huge. I don't want that. So you could add .iso as a pattern to be ignored.
Oh. Why is that under bad?
It's under bad because it has the default of some patterns set up.
Okay.
Which are on by default. Including starts with foo and ends with bar. Which are purely samples of what you can do, but they're on. So if this is the default setting, all a bad guy has to do to make their virus invisible to ClamXAV is end their file name in bar or start their file name in foo. Which is ironically foobar.
Which, if you don't know what it stands for, go look it up in Wikipedia or Urban Dictionary.
I think it's originally a military term.
Yes, it is.
It's not polite.
It's F-U-B-A-R.
Yes. Anyway, so I think that's just an insane default. Why would you, as a default, give a route for every attacker on the planet to name their file in such a way that it's invisible to your antivirus? Why would you do that?
Yeah, that was not the... that would be worth pointing out to them, because they probably thought they were being helpful.
Well, yeah, if they just uncheck the enabled boxes, they would be being helpful, because they're nice example patterns of what you can do.
Right, or have that in the help file, maybe, or something.
I like the idea of putting in samples, actually, because there's nothing more obvious than a sample.
Sure, but don't enable it.
It's nice because it has a little description. It has a little text file where you enter the pattern and a little description after it. And so it shows you starts with is a little caret sign, ends with is the dollar sign.
Oh, yeah, an example.
And it has a little image description next to it, you know, starts with foo, ends with bar. So they're really good illustrative examples, but they shouldn't be on.
I think that one's worth dropping them a note, because I bet they didn't think about that.
I should do, actually.
Clearly, they didn't. All right, so how about for a normal human?
Okay, so let's go about setting this up then. So you download and install the app. The first time you run it, it'll pop up a little thing. So you download only the GUI, and you drag and drop it to install. You double-click it to run, and it says, you have a GUI, but you don't have an antivirus engine yet. Would you like me to install the antivirus engine so this will actually do anything?
Okay.
You click yes, and then a little package installer comes up, and that's when it actually goes and installs the Unix stuff in the background.
Yeah, my understanding of why that happens is because that's the way the licenses work, that if you package one thing inside another, you have, might end up with separate licenses, so it's easier to just have it go get it separately.
My understanding is it's a really nice way to have an installer without having to package an installer. So it comes as a normal app that you can do a drag and drop install, so you don't have to teach your family anything unusual. Mm-hmm. And then it looks after itself the first time you run it. So I actually think it's a nice way to do it.
Sure.
So you do that, and then you have your working Climax AV, and it's sitting there in front of you. Then you need to click on the preferences icon in the top right corner, and you need to make some changes. First thing you want to do is turn on the automatic update for virus definitions in the schedule tab of the settings window, and choose a frequency and a time that works for you. If you're the kind of person who only uses their computer at the weekend, maybe have it happen every Saturday. If you're the kind of person, you know, who only uses the computer on weekdays, only allow it to happen on weekdays and that kind of thing. It'll be up to you when your computer is likely to be on, but just have the automatic updates on so that your virus definitions don't get, you know, weeks out of date.
Sure.
I would suggest turning on the Sentry, because otherwise you don't have a traditional AV like you're used to from the Windows world. So if you don't turn that on, you're not really getting the protection you think you're getting from having an AV.
Sure.
So you turn that on by clicking the checkbox that says Launch Clam XAV Sentry when you log into this computer, and it's over in the Sentry tab in the preference window.
Okay.
Then you need to give it some folders to actually watch, because otherwise it still isn't doing anything.
Why not just tell it, watch my whole computer?
Because you don't own your whole computer. So because OS X is a Unix-based system, you're really only controlling your home directory. So that's all you're really going to be doing with Sentry. It's your stuff. So if you're a Pyro user, I would say just watch the downloads folder. That's the entry and exit of your computer.
That's where you're going to muck things up.
Exactly. If you keep an eye on that, that's where you're going to nab the stuff as it comes in. If you're doing it for a family member who's not particularly tech savvy, I would say add their home directory and just be done with it.
Yeah. So you don't think that'd be good for a regular power user? Why would that be bad?
Well, it's not so much that it'll
just
be bad,
unnecessary.
Power users care. It's unnecessary. Yeah, I think it's unnecessary. And power users are the kind of people who fret about an extra CPU cycle here or there and a tiny little bit of extra memory. So if you want to minimize the footprint of this thing, to have it interfere with your life as little as possible while still getting protection, I think the downloads folder is a good compromise.
Okay. Sounds good.
Now, when you add a folder, there's a checkbox next to the name of the folder. It's a very, very important checkbox. It does default to the right answer, which is include subfolders. But if you accidentally uncheck that, it's not going to do what you think it's doing because it won't go down into subfolders. So if you've got your home directory and you don't have that checkbox checked, it's only checking the actual top-level folder of your home directory where no one ever puts anything.
Okay, good.
So definitely check that. If you're a home user, something else you could consider, but only if you do not plug in lots of external hard drives, there's an option to have it automatically scan an external drive when it's plugged in. This is a really bad idea if you're in a corporate environment and connecting to network shares.
Okay.
This is a really bad idea if you have a 2 gigabyte external hard drive that you plug in regularly.
2 terabyte, you mean?
Yeah. Okay. Oh yeah, 2 gig is fine. But if you're the kind of person who only ever has the odd person come over with a thumb drive to help you out with something, then it's a good idea.
Oh, okay. All right.
I would use caution on that one.
But that's good. I like you've given us different variations for where we use it. I definitely hook up, like I'm hooked up to the Drobo. That would be really bad.
Oh, good Lord. It would take forever. You mount the thing and then 4 hours later, your machine is still churning away.
Bart said this was light on my system. He lied to
exactly,
me.
Exactly. And then you end up saying Bart was wrong because look at it. It's destroying my system, but that'll be why. And if you want to make your network admins very annoyed in the corporate environment, have about, you know, 100 people in the organization use Clam XAV and have them all have it scan every file share when they log into it. That'll really drive up the network traffic.
Basically get a denial of service attack on your entire network. That's neat.
Yeah, that is a way to become really unpopular. So the other thing I would say is to think about is whether or not you want a quarantine folder. If you'd like to have Clam XAV automatically move stuff into a quarantine folder, you first have to specify what folder you would like that to be.
Oh, okay.
So there's actually a tab in the preferences called quarantine, and you simply point it at a folder, and then you have the option to, when it finds something, to automatically quarantine it. I don't like doing that, because then the file has been moved from where it was, and if it's some sort of false positive, then how do I put it back?
Right. Right. And
I really don't like it being deleted automatically.
You have very few diagnostics as it is. You're losing the only one you have, which is where was it?
Yeah. So I don't use the quarantine.
Quarantine folder. Okay.
But I have family members who really, really, really want it to. They don't want to have to go looking for the file because that's too hard. And that's a reasonable point because these things can be hidden anywhere. They can be inside a .app bundle and all these kind of things. So depending, again, on the scenario, if you just want them, I don't care what it is. If it's got a virus, I want it away. Quarantine is at least better than delete. So for a lot of people, I would say, okay, quarantine's a good compromise. Personally, I'm happy to follow file paths myself. So as an advanced user, I wouldn't bother.
Okay.
But it's another judgment call to make.
Sure.
And that's it. Then it's all set up and running, and you don't have to worry about it.
So just let her run, huh?
Now, one quirk is that when you check the checkbox that says, start Sentry when I log into my computer, that will only start Sentry the next time you log into your computer.
Okay, I don't understand the distinction. Why is that bad? It's not going to start right now.
It's not going to start.
Oh, okay.
So when you do these changes, log out and log back in, and then you're done.
Ah, okay, gotcha.
And so really, that's sort of all the main points I have. I have in the show notes just a couple of quick conclusions to wrap it up. Been using it for 3 weeks, I'm happy. I have my odd quibble, but I'm happy.
That's saying a lot.
Yeah, it's just sitting there in the background, it's not annoying me. And when I've had a couple of cases where people have emailed me stuff and said, this looks suspicious, what do you think? And I just right-click, scan with ClamXAV, and it's gone, no, that's fine, and I've been happy with that. So I like it, it's working for me.
So you think you're going to keep it on your personal computer?
Yep. It's here on this computer as I'm talking to you right now, and it's staying. It's not going away.
Wow. I'm keeping it.
So there we go. That's something. I think this is user-friendly enough to stick on your non-tech-savvy relatives' Macs. So I wouldn't let them set it up. I'd go over, I'd install it, I'd make sure it's all set up the way you want, and then you can forget about it, and they're protected.
Pretty nice. I think I might do that. All right, yeah. Well, let's see. We set a goal of, 10 to 15 minutes, and we've been going 24.
See, we work on 120-second minutes, Alice.
That's right.
Well, in that case, how's about I wrap up with this? Best value money AV I've seen for the Mac. It works, and it's free.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bart. Appreciate the review.
No problem at all, and talk to you next time with my proper theme music and stuff. Until then, happy computing.
Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit-Chat Across the Pond. And this week we have a very new guest to the show, good friend of the show, Pierre Bourgeois from Canada. Did I pronounce it right, Pierre?
Yes, you did. Roll the R.
We've been practicing it. I remember we tried that a while ago. Well, I'm excited to have you on the show because you actually suggested this topic, which is to kind of compare and contrast the different kinds of services that we all know and love in technology between the Canada and the United States.
Yeah, it's interesting because we're neighbors, and you know, for the most part, a lot of technology and media, it's the same on both sides of the border, but there are differences, and they're frustrating. It's very rare that we're going to get something here that you guys don't have. It seems to be a one-way street.
I think we were talking in show prep about, is it better or worse than, say, being in Belgium where you're never going to get it, or where in Canada where it's like it's so close, it just feels like it ought to work.
Well, it teaches you patience. But it is probably better than Belgium and a few other countries in Europe and other places.
Yeah, I bet. So the first thing you wanted to talk about, we want to just get an idea of your background of where'd you come from a technology perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not in the technology area. I work in a boring area called accounting and income tax.
Ooh, woo-hoo! Exactly. Wild man.
Yeah, but all my friends are engineers, so that's kind of odd. I guess I was the only dumb one who had to go into accounting. And, you know, my first computer, I was sharing an apartment after university with a friend of mine who happens to be an engineer, and he had a Mac, so I got a Mac. Probably about 84, 85. It was one of the first ones. And that computer lasted 10 years.
Wow.
And actually, when I got rid of it, it was still working, believe it or not. And I switched over to the Windows side back then. So that would have been 95. I went to the dark side.
Well, a lot of people did lose faith along there. I got to admit, even I didn't buy a new Mac in that era. I bought a used one off my friend Ron.
Yeah, I mean, it was, the software wasn't available and, you didn't know quite what to buy. It wasn't a great period. So
yeah.
Kept on with the Windows stuff until my daughter was a teenager. So here's my daughter doing what a teenage daughter is going to do, which is downloading stuff from LimeWire and whatnot. So her Windows machine would crash about every 3 weeks, and we'd have to rebuild it.
Jeez.
So around that time, the Intel Mac came out. So I figured, let's try with the Mini, see if this works out. And it was really funny, actually, setting it up, because it was familiar, although it was 10 years later. The interface still had a lot of the same look and feel from the 1980s. It was obviously a lot very modernized, but it still had a similar look. And got her running on a Mac, no problems. Everything worked fine. And then slowly converted myself and the rest of the family.
Cool. So you're happier there now?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Windows has come a long ways, but it's still, I don't know, for me at least, it's just not happy making.
Yeah, and it's probably, I mean, where I work, we use Windows and we'll probably continue to. For the foreseeable future, just because there's some software that only runs on Windows.
You're not supposed to be happy in accounting anyway.
No, you're not. No, no. And but probably part of that, too, is I think in larger organizations that, Windows gets even worse because there's a whole bunch of restrictions and the like that are imposed that, make you not able to use the machine the way you would want to.
Right. So even if it would have been fun, it isn't anymore. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think a lot of podcasters and people in the tech industry live in a world where they have choice and can mess around with things a lot more than people in, let's call it, real industry. And they don't understand those kinds of restrictions, especially like they think there's free Wi-Fi everywhere. I don't know about you, but there's not free Wi-Fi anywhere near me ever, 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 except at Starbucks.
Well, at home, at the office, you're good.
Oh, yeah. We don't even have it at the office.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so.
No, we do, so that's a good thing. There's a couple of places, but I think you're right. It's pretty well hit and miss. The Wi-Fi everywhere is still a slogan and not reality.
Right. What about iOS and that sort of thing? Are you getting to use that at work at all?
A little bit. We're just trying out using the iPhone and the iPad. So we've got a pilot project. We've, of course, been BlackBerry 100%.
Now, RIM is a Canadian company. Is there any pressure to, buy Canadian?
No.
Oh, that's good.
No, I think it's really coming from the younger generation, the younger people in the organization, because we don't subsidize the cost of the equipment. We pay for the monthly fee, but the equipment the employee has to pay himself.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
And I think that is probably creates a situation where, especially among the 20-somethings, they're sort of going, I got to pay for this, and you want me to get a BlackBerry? No. because they're used to using Android or iPhones. And
just ain't buying it, right?
Yeah.
So, literally.
Exactly. So I think that's one of the reasons. And, one thing that's always amazed me about BlackBerry is that it's a machine that's used by business people for the most part.
Sure.
Although they've gotten into the personal area in the last 3 or 4 years. And it's really poor at doing one thing, and that's looking at attachments.
Mm.
And that's always mystified me, because who gets email today and gets attachments? Business people.
Oh, right. Yeah, in your play life, you don't get – I mean, I'm not mailing you a Word file of a joke or something, right?
Right. Or an exciting Excel spreadsheet.
I hadn't thought about that.
And that's where BlackBerry is really weak. And when you compare an iPhone or an iPad with a BlackBerry, that's where they really shine.
Sure.
So I think we're going to see a lot of that. In fact, it was interesting. I was talking to the VP technology at another company in the building I work at. And this is a crown corporation, a fairly large one, which you'd expect to be really stuffy because it's a government company, right? Mm-hmm. Security paranoid. And what he was telling me is that probably within a year, they're going to move towards bring your own device. Not bring your own booze, but bring your own device. Wow. And he's really looking forward to it because the reason they can do that is that pretty well everything they have is through a web interface.
Oh, okay.
So he doesn't have to fight specific machines.
Sure.
And what he's really looking forward to is saving money because as people are, if you give people a certain amount and you say, here's the amount that we'll pay, and some people decide to get Macs, some people will get a Windows machine, he's going, from my perspective, that's it. I'm not going to maintain those machines anymore. And I'm going to save a lot of money because we spend a lot of time doing that. So I thought it was interesting.
Oh, that is interesting.
Yeah.
So speaking about cell phones like the iPhones and Blackberries and all that, how do the pricing plans and your freedoms compare to what we have in the U.S.? And I use the word freedom in the U.S. as with air quotes.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't get the iPhone when it first came out. It took so the first version wasn't available. It was the second iteration of the iPhone that was available. And at that point, there was only one carrier. Because there was only one carrier in Canada that had the right type of network. The two other large carriers then switched their networks so that they would be compatible with iPhones. So since iPhone 4, we have a choice of three carriers.
Oh, three. How nice.
Yeah. Although you might say five, because what we have in Canada is really funny. Each one of the major carriers also has like a secondary brand. Hmm. For budget, so you'll have Bell Canada, so you could go to Bell Canada, or go to Virgin. Virgin is wholly owned by them, and that's their bargain brand.
Oh, huh.
They target typically for younger consumers, and all the other two cellular providers provide the same thing. The thing that's weird, I mean, there you would hope that would create competition, but it really doesn't.
Oh, really? Why?
You know, they kind of stick to their prices. They look at what the other guy is doing and kind of stick to it. Although, you know, one of the things that it does do is initially when tethering or personal hotspot now, I guess, was made available, all three of them give it to you for free, basically. If you have a data plan of 1 gig or more, you can use
just
hotspot.
Get it? Oh, yeah. That would be nice. I would like that.
Yeah, so there's no additional charge. Now, as far as pricing, I mean, if you just kind of walk in and ask for a data plan and you want something, you know, 5 or 6 gigs, typically it's 6 gigs that you max out at for the, you know, unlimited, you know, it might be $50 or $60, but for the most part, whenever the iPhone comes out, they're all trying to get some business. And they typically will offer a promotion. And, you know, I've been paying $30 a month for 6 gigs.
Jeez.
So that's not too bad.
Yeah. And, well, that sounds like a good choice to me.
Yeah. The one negative, though, and all three carriers have exactly the same policy, is that if you want a subsidized price on your phone, and the subsidy they gave us is exactly the same as you get in the U.S., exactly the same pricing. You have to sign a 3-year contract.
3-year, not 2-year.
No.
Oh, geez.
And that's kind of silly.
Right.
Because you're not going to keep your phone for 3 years.
Right.
I'm not. I mean, I've been changing mine every year. iPhone 4, I might keep an extra year depending if what comes out eventually. But
to have right that now, freedom. And, yeah. And it's such a misnomer. I mean, I watched a friend of my daughter's buy a 3GS because it was $50 less than the or $100 less than the four. And I'm like, really? Do you have any idea how much that phone actually costs you over time?
Yeah. Well, one nice thing that's changed, and that's because of consumer laws, actually. is that in the past, the penalties were just crazy.
Right.
I mean, you'd have to pay hundreds of dollars to get out of your contract.
Yeah, ours is still now, $175 to get out.
Yeah, that's – but ours – we could be caught paying $400, $500, $600 to get out of a contract.
Oh, my gosh.
So even more than the subsidy that you receive. So that made no sense. So now, because of people getting really annoyed, the rule now that all the companies have to follow is they the penalty is whatever is left on the subsidy.
And that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it does. So, I mean, if you have – you know, after 2 years, you decide to change. Well, you'll have to pay one third of the subsidy back to them.
That makes perfect sense.
It does. It does. So that means that it makes more sense to get a subsidized phone than it did in the past. So that's been positive.
Yeah. I don't understand how they get away with anything other than that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean it's not perfect. It's probably, you know, the 3 year business is, I think, still the problem up here.
Yeah. And, so, do you tend to buy your phones unsubsidized then?
The last one I did, and the main reason for that is that roaming charges that we pay are obscene. So if I happen to go to the U.S. Or to Europe or anywhere else, I could easily rack up, in the space of a week or even a long weekend, $300-$400.
Oh, jeez.
So.
Well, wait a minute. Roaming within Canada?
No, not within Canada.
The minute you step outside. The
minute we step outside and we go into the U.S.
So why is that Canada's fault? That's our fault, right?
Well, I that's interesting. I'm not sure about that because I think it was the OECD that came out with a report of how much each country charges for roaming fees outside of their country. And Canada was like 20 or 30 times higher.
So you're actually charged by your Canadian ISP?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so if I'm flipping on the AT&T network, you know, whatever contract the cellular provider in Canada has with AT&T, that's what they pay AT&T. The markup that they take, the additional profit that they make when they charge me is
oh, okay. Huge. I always thought that was charged by the country that you were in, not the country you came from. But yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it's a bit of both. Yeah,
it's worse than the U.S.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking about it, even with the U.S. pricing, finally getting an unlocked iPhone on AT&T, if you're going to go to Europe once and want to use your phone, it's worth it to get the unsubsidized phone.
Yeah.
I mean, you can easily knock out that extra $400 in charges by just, you know, checking maps once a day, I think.
Exactly. I mean, you can hear, if you are a frequent traveler to the U.S., and there are a lot of people that are, there are plans that are reasonable. So instead of paying $30 a month, you'll pay $60 or $70 a month, but you've got your full data coverage in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So for people who spend a lot of time in the U.S., you're okay. But if you're just going down for vacations, going down to Florida during spring break and stuff like that, you know, you can come back and have a really nasty cell phone bill.
Yeah. Yeah, even if you're really careful and you monitor it and all that kind of stuff, it seems you can really get screwed easily.
Yeah, last time I was down in the States, I really, you know, put it in airplane mode and turned off roaming and then would just use it every once in a while. But even then, I came back and I had a $300 bill.
Jeez.
So that's
being careful. Why not go and have fun?
Yeah, exactly.
You might as well enjoy yourself for $300, right? Yeah.
And if you're, you know, if you're in the States and you have your iPhone, it really reduces the value of the iPhone as a traveling companion.
Yeah, and if you are as addicted to it as we are, you certainly notice it when it's gone.
Absolutely, because I've found on the last couple of vacations, I've been using my iPhone a lot. You know, I have the guide for the particular area I'm going to and, you know, using localization services to find restaurants and stuff like that. It's just
the whole
wonderful
point of having it.
Right? Yeah, it's really having a concierge in your pocket, basically.
Oh, I love it when you speak French. All right. That was a little confession right there. Let's move on. And as much as I don't listen to music, I think there's people that listen to the show that actually do. How's music compare?
Well, it took a little while for music to be offered on the iTunes store. Probably, I can't remember the exact date, probably a year and a half, 2 years later than in the U.S. And that's probably the way the music business is set up, because the way it's set up is that when you're buying a CD in Canada, for example, if anyone still is, you look at the back and it says it's been licensed to, you know, by PolyGram Netherlands to PolyGram Canada, and that's what you're getting. So each country has their own licensing. So I guess when Apple, and that's what's amazing about Apple having made music available in so many countries, is that they basically have to negotiate with the labels in each country because they have their own. That's just the way the business evolved over time.
We were talking show prep about how just say we want to pay for stuff.
Yeah,
Let us.
Yeah.
Just, you know, come on.
And it, you know what? So as far as the selection on iTunes, it's good. It's very good. Both international artists, Canadian artists, French language artists as well now. But the alternative of going to Amazon is not there for us.
Oh, really?
No, not at all. Amazon does not offer MP3s in Canada. I know they offer them in the UK. I'm not sure if they offer them in any other country. You know, Amazon is much more limited as far as offering their digital content than Apple has been. I guess Apple's worked really hard at getting it into all those countries.
I guess we should appreciate that.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of take it for granted. It's like, well, duh. Why wouldn't you? But I guess having negotiated with people before, the idea of negotiating with countries, that's got to be so tiresome.
Well, you got to, you know, because let's face it, in each country, you're negotiating with the record executives, right?
Yeah.
You know, these are not people that like to get their stuff out digitally. There's a reticence, and it's frustrating. It's funny sometimes because there are some artists, you know, if I go to look at the French iTunes store or the U.S. iTunes store, I'll see artists that are available there that are not available here. But it goes the other way as well.
What about books?
Books, actually, the iPad and the Kindle have been a wonderful thing for people who read a lot. Before we had good access to digital books, Canadian book prices were typically 40% higher than
kidding.
U.S. Yeah.
Really?
So you would pick up, and what was really frustrating about it is, believe it or not, this is what publishers would do. When you looked at the back of the book where the price is, they would put the U.S. price and the Canadian price.
Oh, I remember that when I was a little kid.
Yeah,
I grew up in Michigan, so Canada was right there.
Yeah, so you'd see that. So you'd see, you know, let's say $9.99 is the U.S. price, and it'll be 40% higher for the Canadian. And this is physically, it's the same book that you're buying.
Now that was okay because the exchange rates were pretty far apart, right?
Yeah, but even if you factored in the exchange rates, it was often, so let's say, you know, it was 1 to 1.2, so you'd expect the $10 book to be a 12, it would still be 14. There was always that sort of that premium. But when Kindle became available here in Canada, we buy from the U.S. store. There's no specific. We don't go to.
You don't have a Canadian version. Okay.
No, I don't go to Amazon.ca. I go to Amazon.com.
And is that legal?
Yeah, absolutely. Huh. Absolutely. The only thing is that'll happen is sometimes certain titles are not available if you're Canadian. Because they don't have the license to.
We want to buy stuff. Let us. Sorry.
No, exactly. Exactly. So in a case like that, it's what's probably happened is that the publisher has signed an agreement with one of the Canadian electronic publishers that they have exclusive rights.
Right, right.
So, for example, when I wanted to read the Larson books you know, the Hornet, you know, the girl with the Hornet and all that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I couldn't buy them on Amazon. I had to buy them on Kobo, which is the other choice that we have up here in Canada. So if we want to buy books, it's actually pretty good. There's Amazon as an alternative, and there's Kobo. And you can read your books on the iPad, no problem. So, and the prices are generally
pretty good.
Pretty good.
It sounds like you're with me, though, that I read ahead in the show notes that the iBook store is, you know, it might be fine, but it's so limited, it's just not worth the trouble.
It's pathetic up here.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's bad in the U.S., it's we've probably got 10%.
Jeez.
If you, I would just yesterday, I opened it up and I looked at their top sellers. There was an Orson Welles book in the top sellers. you know the $2.99 job.
Gotta love him, but still.
Well, he's a great author. You know,
it's not exactly recent.
But it just shows you how poor the library is. There's just nothing there.
You know what? I broke down and finally I was going to read a Jodi Picoult book, and I checked, and it was available in iBooks. And I've been reading a lot of Amazon Kindle, but I thought, okay, I'll give them another try. Yeah. And they had the book, so that was good. But it's slow.
Yeah.
It takes a long time to open the books. It's like, come on, this is like tiny little kilobytes of a file. Why does it take you that long? And yeah, even changing the pages, it's like, okay, that animation was cute the first day. I'm tired of it now. You know, maybe you can even turn it off. I haven't checked, but I went straight back to the Kindle. As soon as I could finish that book, I was like, oh, get me out of here.
Yeah, and I'm exactly the same now. I mean, 90-95% of books that I'll buy will be off the Kindle.
Yeah.
I'll only buy off another one if it's not available there.
And the flexibility too that's available is great. The you know, to be able to read it on your iPhone when you're, you know, in a pinch, mm-hmm, you're on your iPad, you're on a Kindle. I'm thinking of getting a Kindle.
Yeah, I've had one for a year or so. Especially at this time of year when you're out, you can be up here, you can be outside next to the pool and reading. It's nice to have the Kindle.
Exactly. That's what I'm thinking. I'm about we're going to go on vacation in a little while, and I'm thinking I don't want to take my iPad to the pool, even if I could read outdoors, which I pretty much can't.
And actually, for a Canadian, there's kind of a loophole if you get a Kindle.
Hmm.
Remember, I was saying that there's certain books that I can't buy.
Yeah.
Well, that's true if I go to Amazon.com or I go through the iPad. If I go through my Kindle, it thinks I'm American. I guess.
Okay. So you have more choice.
Yeah. If I really want to get the book, I'll open up my Kindle, purchase it off the Kindle store, and then the funny thing is, it syncs back to the iPad.
Right, right, right. That's what I mean. That automatic whisper sync thing is fantastic. I really like that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
All right. Well, this wasn't supposed to be the Kindle show, but that's good to know the books are going well. Now, how about television?
TV. Well,
we're all pissed at Netflix down here this week. So go ahead, say something nice about Netflix.
Well, you know, my reaction when that Netflix stuff came out, so that from what I understand in the U.S., you were paying $10 and you got the streaming and the DVDs.
Right.
Netflix was never in the DVD business up here.
Oh, so they started with just streaming.
That's right. There was a Netflix clone up here called Zip.
Hmm.
And they did exactly the same as Netflix. But Netflix just came in this year with their $8 for the unlimited streaming. So, and that's all we get up here. So when all this stuff happened this week, I said, well, so they're giving you the same prices as Canadians. So, so we don't have an option for the DVD. The one difference up here is that, and again, it's this silliness about licensing, is that you'll go on the site or off your TV and you'll look for a title and they'll say, oh, that's not available in Canada, but you might enjoy this show. And some of the choices they give you just are basically don't make any sense. You know, you're looking for an action movie and they talk to you about romances and you're going, no, this is just odd.
It's not a good alternative.
It's not, and especially... And again, it's the whole thing about licensing.
Hey, can I say it again? We want to pay for stuff. Let us.
And, you know, some of the, like, TV shows is an example. What'll happen is that, especially the shows that are still on television first run, is that Netflix can't get them because it's the Canadian network who bought the rights will always, to broadcast it, will always buy the rights to show it digitally. Mm-hmm. For a period of time. So especially television programs, we have a much smaller selection than I think you guys get in the U.S. And it's the same with movies. It depends what the deals the studio did with the cable companies and other traditional broadcasters. So I can't look at the libraries in both.
Right.
But I suspect that we probably have maybe 60% of the titles you do.
Well,
but that's still a good deal.
The problem is that they're changing all the time too. My daughter called me the other day and she was furious because about 50% of her instant streaming queue disappeared one day. And again, it had to do with messing around with digital rights management crapola and them not letting us buy what we want to buy. You know, really?
Yeah, and it doesn't make sense. And even for, I think it was the James Bond movies that became available on Netflix, but only for like a month. I mean, this is not new content. I mean, Netflix is there especially for older content.
Right. But they'll get into these deals with, I forget which company, stupid idiotic company it was, but lump them all together, that they had suddenly decided that it was going too well. Like the only reason I ever watched Dexter was because it was on Netflix. I never knew about it until it was on Netflix because I don't buy HBO. And all of a sudden, that's all gone.
Yeah.
They just got rid of it.
So, and
so tiresome.
Who knows? Maybe their logic is saying, We'll put it on Netflix for a while. Let's say take an example
teaser
of a long runner like The Wire. Mm-hmm. People get hooked on it, but they've only gotten through season two. Then we yank it, and then we can sell them the DVD box set.
I don't know
if that's a logic.
I don't want to own television. For some reason, I love owning movies, and I'll watch them over and over and over again. We've got about 300 of them, but TV shows? I don't want to go back and watch that.
No, you're right. I think most television programs, they're like fast food. You eat them, that's it. It's finished.
Exactly. Perfect description.
Yeah. It's like tacos.
Taco Bell Thursday. That is an important... We didn't even put this in the show notes. Do you have Taco Bell?
Yes, we do.
Oh.
Not many of them.
Do you have any nearby?
Close. Actually, three blocks away.
And have you ever gone on a Thursday?
No.
You plan to, I'm sure, though.
I will.
And I would like a picture of you. And anybody listening who does go to Taco Bell, it helps if it's on a Thursday, but I'd love a picture of you with the Taco Bell.
we might have to do that on Google One or something, create a Taco Bell circle or something.
Google Plus. That would be great. I love it. So now you're actually a native French speaker, is that right?
Yeah.
It doesn't show. You sound like a native English speaker to me.
Well, I'm actually native both.
Oh.
my parents were bilingual, so I learned both languages growing up, which was great.
Okay. My mother was born in Michigan, but in the Upper Peninsula, and so spent a lot of time with her grandmother up in Canada, and so she grew up bilingual as well.
Yeah. No, it's it's a nice advantage.
Yeah, definitely.
Different books and movies and stuff like that, different culture.
So how does that work for you in the digital arena?
Well, music is okay. Books is a disaster.
Mm.
And that's because of the French in France.
You blame the French?
Absolutely.
Don't blame Canada, but you can blame the French?
Absolutely, because, I mean, they're such a big part of the French market. So whatever they do is going to impact the rest of the French world. The French, many years ago, came out with a law. It's called the Lang Law, named after the politician who spearheaded it. And that law says that you are not allowed to sell books for less than 95% of their list price. And that law came out before the digital age.
So that means there's no used book market.
I'm assuming not.
Yeah.
I'm assuming not. And in fact, Amazon got into trouble. Because in France, like they do here, they offer free shipping.
Mm-hmm.
And the book editors in France lodged a complaint a complaint rather, saying, well, if you're giving free shipping, that means you're giving more than a 5% discount. So that's illegal. So Amazon...
Even though it was for the shipping.
Yeah. So Amazon is obliged to sell the books for no less than 95%. And what the French did recently, from what I understand, I'm not a French lawyer, so I have no competence in the area, so it's what I read on the internet, but they've extended that to the digital sphere. So it appears that what that means is that French books, even though they're in digital form, have to be at a price that's 95% of...
Don't say the list price of the hardback.
Or the list price of the hardback, yeah. Because there's in French books, there's more softbacks. You know that type of book that's in between a hardback and a paperback?
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of a thicker cover, but it's still flexible.
Yeah, and it's a little bit bigger than a paperback.
Right.
That seems to be the norm. And French books are terribly expensive. You'll take a book that you would expect to pay, even let's say a hardback that you would expect to pay $20 at a bookstore. You'll be easily paying $27, $28. So very expensive. And the result of that is that there is absolutely, not absolutely none, there are some digital books, but it is so minute that it's irrelevant. So if you go to Amazon.fr, you will not see any books.
Oh, geez.
So French speakers are being, you can get digital content, newspapers and the like, but as far as books are concerned, forget it. So some of my friends, they'll ask me, they'll say, you know, I'm thinking of getting my mom or my grandmother or my grandfather a Kindle or an iPad. And one of the questions I always ask them, I said, is it because you think it would be great for them to have that because they read a lot? And if they say yes, then the next question is, do they read in English or French? And if they tell me they read in French, I go, eh.
Don't do it.
It's not going to be worth it.
That's so sad.
I hope Grandpa likes Angry Birds because he's not going to be able to read that much. You
know? Oh, what a drag. That's terrible. All right. Well, what about, let's see, what's up next on our list? Are we to Apple products? Or no, we were still talking about the French stuff. So about music in French?
Music in French is pretty good, I'd say. But they are slow in getting the back catalog in. So the recent stuff is going in, but some of the older music is harder to get. But it's not that bad. I don't have any complaints. And, you know, software, of course, is not a problem. Because software, the licensing for software, there's none of this... You know, different software licenses for Canada, U.S., and Germany.
Oh, there isn't.
If there are, they're not. You know, they're covered in the license agreement with. You know, in Canada, this is different. In Germany, this is different. But
so, if you went into the Amazon.com site to buy a piece of boxed software, you and I would see the same thing.
Yeah.
And how about? Do you guys have the Mac App Store?
Yes, we do.
And it just acts like anything we describe and talk about on the show. You can find it.
Yeah, I've never encountered any situation where I'll click on something and it'll say, oh, you're Canadian. Sorry, you can't get this. And that'll happen on the internet as well. You know, when I was talking about the frustration of this geographic sandbox is that if someone posts a Colbert Report extract on a blog or something and I click on it, I will get a black screen that'll say, oh, you're in Canada. You can't see this. You have to go to...
Oh, so it's not real obvious when you can't have it.
Exactly.
They don't just not find it, say file not found. It just says, you're Canadian. We don't need your money.
Exactly. Exactly. But software is generally not a problem. Huh. The one thing about Apple stuff, though, is the pricing that is annoying.
It's not good?
Well... Our Canadian dollar now is at, well, in fact, it's 5 cents over the U.S. dollar. But we've been pretty well at par for the last couple of years. So, you know, the Canadian loonie is equal to the U.S. dollar. But when I walk into an Apple store or go to the Apple store online, I'll pay between, depending on the hardware, 5, 10, sometimes even 15% more.
Really?
And it's not a sales tax issue. Because when you look at the price on the Canadian store, it's before sales tax.
That, well, it doesn't make any sense at all.
No, it doesn't.
It's just to be mean, huh?
Well, in defense of Apple, I think, you know, there's been a lot of variation in exchange rates. And, you know, they think in U.S. dollars, they sell in U.S. dollars. And so they want to give themselves a buffer in case the Canadian dollar ever drops.
Yeah, I wonder. I've heard they do that, though, for other countries. I think when we sell to Europe, well, when Apple sells to Europe, there's a pretty significant markup, and then they've got that VAT tax nonsense on top of that.
Yeah, well, I mean, we have taxes as well, both federal and provincial. So that'll we'll add, depending on the province you're in, between 5 and 14% above and beyond. But the prices are a little bit higher, not as high as what I've heard Europeans complain about. It's a 5% difference for the most part, which isn't as bad.
So, okay, keep quiet about that one, Pierre. Yeah. It could be worse, right?
Could be worse.
All right, now, if you're Canadian, you're French to some extent, what do you do about keyboards and that sort of thing?
Well, there is a format of keyboard that is specific to Quebec, if you will, or Canada. Because we don't use the same – we use the same keyboard as Americans do.
Okay.
So it's essentially the same with added keys on it for accented characters.
Oh, because you don't like hitting the option key to do it?
Exactly.
Okay.
You know, it's a lot faster if you can just hit one or perhaps two keys. So your options are either to get the standard North American keyboard – and then you can use the French format and type. Like, you can change the format of your keyboard on any Mac. And there are shortcuts that are there if you use the Canadian French keyboard, or you buy a Canadian French keyboard with your Mac.
Well, so would you just sit there switching? Like, today I want to write in French, I'm going to plug this keyboard in, but I'm going to write in English, I want to switch to this one?
It depends on the software. If I'm in Mail, for example, Mail will auto-recognize the language I'm in.
Oh.
Which is kind of neat.
And what does that mean, to auto-recognize it? What does it do?
Well, after two or three words, it'll go, oh, okay, you're writing in English, I'm going to use the English dictionary.
Oh, okay, you're talking about the dictionary, but I was asking about the keyboard. I mean, if you're going to write in English, do you plug in the English keyboard, and then when I'm going to write in French, no. I plug in the French keyboard?
No. No, I'm always using the same keyboard layout.
Which is the French or English one?
The French one.
Oh, okay. So if you start with the French one, then you can get your special characters, but then you can still type in English if you need to.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. One thing that's nice with the iOS devices is that it's really easy to switch language when you're typing.
How come? It's got a virtual keyboard.
Because it's got a virtual keyboard. And if you've, in your preferences, if you've added a secondary or a third keyboard, it's really easy to switch from one to the other. So if I'm using my iPad and I'm writing something in French, because the default language I have would be English, I just click on the little globe on the virtual keyboard and it'll toggle to the French keyboard.
Oh,
and okay. To the French dictionary.
Oh, that's got to be sweet.
Which is fantastic, because that way I don't make typos. this can even be useful, I guess, for people who use a second language sometimes, but not all that often. So I guess maybe someone in the States where you might have some writing in Spanish, but not all that frequently. If you have the Spanish keyboard set up on your iPad, you can switch to the Spanish keyboard, and at least there it'll pick up your typos. Probably won't fix your grammar or sentences, but it'll pick up your typos.
You have to do some work yourself, right?
absolutely. Yeah.
Well, this has been really interesting, Pierre. I really like hearing the differences. You know, it's just like anything else, whether we're talking about disabilities or, you know, different enabling technologies. It's interesting to hear the differences between the countries, too. I like learning about this kind of thing.
Yeah, I guess at the end of the day, it's the same, but slightly different.
All right. Well, let's see. What's your name on Twitter, Pierre?
It's Boo, B-O-U, Pierre.
Oh, I've always called it Beau Pierre when I said it.
Well, that's actually better because, you know, Beau means, you know, nice, attractive. So
there you go. You'll take that.
I'll take that. That's
right. All right. I'm going to make a special request. I want you to sign us out in French. Or at least with a really cool French accent in English, either way.
No, I'll probably, if I did that, I would sound like Inspector Clouseau. So we're not going to do that. Bonjour, bonsoir tout le monde, à la prochaine.
Well, you really got a twofer there today with Chit Chat Across the Pond with Pierre Bourgeois, but a bonus Bart with his review of Clamex AV. Hope the show's not too long. Man, it's getting longer every week, it seems. It's funny, though, I was so worried I wouldn't have enough content this week because working on the Blog World Expo submissions, but luckily Wade and Caleb came through too, so we got everybody playing and the show went on forever. Anyway, that's going to have to wind us up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsors for helping pay the bills, Screen Steps, and Smile. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. Follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Heck, look me up in Google+. We can talk on Facebook. We got so many ways to talk. It's great fun. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.